Part 4, Chapter 6, in which the listener, who is nothing himself, beholds the nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Footnote. See Wallace Stevens, the poem, The Snowman. Quote, I shall truly go mad, and, being mad, suffer no more. Footnote. Cervantes, Don Quixote, Part 1, Chapter 25. The wooden structure in which Harvey had chosen to rest was cramped and uncomfortable, but despite the small quarters, he managed to sleep until he was awakened by the sound of voices. Putting Pulcinella on his hand, he peeked out and saw a group of children in front of the stage. They began to cheer as soon as they saw the puppet. "Vieni qua," said the mother of one of them. "Non c'è nessuno." Translation. "Come on," said the mother. "There's no one there." The boy looked at his mother and then at the puppet, and was about to leave when Pulcinella took on his personality and began to speak to him. The boy turned back and was starting toward the stage when his mother came over and seized him by the arm. While she was pulling him away, another puppet appeared.
"Vieni qua,"
cried the new arrival.
"Non c'è nessuno."
The mother scowled at the mimicking marionette, but when the children began to laugh, she became embarrassed and released her son. Before long, there was a crowd in front of the theater, and the puppets, taking on the personalities of the audience, began to play scenes and dialogues from their lives. The crowd roared its approval, and the puppets roared back. In the beginning, the captain managed to have some control over the show, but soon the actors took on a life of their own as they were obliged to move and speak in accord with their characters. Each new action limited and multiplied the possibilities of subsequent ones, and revealed the wisdom or stupidity of those before. The goal of the play, Harvey soon discovered, was to prolong the tale in a sort of 1001 nights, for as long as it continued, the captain could be someone, with friends and lovers and family, but as soon as the play was over, he was no one again. The story changed with the changing audience, and Pulcinella altered his behavior as the people cheered or booed, until the performance became an essay in audience participation theater. The emotion Harvey experienced as he worked the marionettes was not like anything he had known before. It seemed his single heart suddenly contained all hearts, and the laughter of the audience bound them together. He was reminded of his friends in Salt Lake City, and the theme of the Treehouse Lounge, dedicated to the cultivation of laughter. But as the crowd thinned out, he began to feel the strain of his 14-hour performance. By midnight, only a young girl remained, approaching the stage with a flower. But before she could give it to the captain, he collapsed, and she was left alone, offering a rose to no one and nothing. As the days passed, the theater's fame grew. Harvey became more and more adept at the manipulation of the slapstick, and he renamed the puppets after his friends and relatives. Footnote. The slapstick, or bastone, is the stick with which Pulcinella beats his rivals, and with which he, in turn, is beaten. Harvey even began to carry finger puppets, or capocelli, for spontaneous performances in the cafes, shows that became especially popular when a Greek figurine joined the cast. His favorite plays were about Pulcinella attacking the devil, and Pulcinella and his friends arranging their first apartment.
"Arrgh!" growled Pulcinella, swinging the slapstick wildly.
"Yeah,
vaffanculo," said Anaximenes. "E come un dolore sordo," said Hesiod. "No, no, e così," said Thales, leaping over Prometheus, catching his foot, and tumbling to the stage.
Harvey had been in Pisa for a month when a man offered to take him to Rome. He was the owner of a shop on the Piazza Navona, and he was sure the puppets would help his business. Harvey was equally sure, but he had never been to that plaza before, and was unprepared for the sea of humanity he found. The plaza was like a medieval fair. There were peasants selling produce, musicians singing ballads, minstrels declaiming poems, barbers cutting hair, doctors peddling potions, scriveners taking letters, soothsayers seeing the future, priests preparing indulgences, and dentists pulling teeth. Harvey quickly moved in among them, and despite its unfortunate location in front of the unpopular shop, his theater became an instant success. It was so popular, in fact, that it inspired others to spring up around it, until the tradition of Pulcinella had been completely revived. But with fame did not come prosperity, for an anarchist tailor named Pasquino began to frequent Harvey's shows, inspiring the captain to perform political dramas that enraged the local authorities. The man so prejudiced Harvey's standing with the law that the captain was often jailed and occasionally flogged. And there were other problems as well. Without a boy to collect the courtesies offered by the spectators, the money that should have belonged to Harvey was tossed indiscriminately toward the stage and was quickly gathered by the ragamuffins who waited there. At the end of the evening, when the captain emerged to collect his due, he found only the worthless 10 and 25 lira pieces of the hundreds of dollars that had been thrown to him. And the theater was having a violent effect on his spirit, for there was a brutality in the Roman tradition that began to infiltrate Harvey's shows. It was the brutality of the ancient Colosseum, of a pillaging empire, the flip side of the Virgin Mary, Dante, Petrarch, and Puccini. Strangely, or perhaps inevitably, the two worlds lived side by side, and the same soul that prayed at St. Peter's in the afternoon cheered for Pulcinella to wield the bastone that night. It was a relationship that was ancient and complex, one which Harvey could easily mirror, but could scarcely understand. Still, despite his problems, the captain and his puppets lasted for 14 weeks as a fixture in the plaza, until one night, after a particularly satirical performance, he was attacked by a group of ruffians hired by the offended authority. The ogres brought their own bastone, and they beat the captain senseless and left his puppets in splinters on the ground. It was well after midnight when our battered hero was visited by a pack of rats, and he followed one of them into a large cardboard box and lay down to sleep. Halfway through Chapter 6, the flight attendant arrived with dinner, and Harvey selected the Salisbury steak and the baked potato. Unfortunately, the plane hit some turbulence while he was eating, and he spilled his entire tray on the page in front of him. He cleaned it as best he could, but when he took up where he left off, he could scarcely read the manuscript through the stains. It had been more than 4 months since Harvey had last bathed, and his skin was besmeared with filth. The people, horrified by his appearance, treated him as if he were a leper, acknowledging him only to cast a scornful and hate-filled glance. Even the animals he met showed no consideration, marking him when he paused to rest. When the weather grew cold, he had to find a home, so he went to the Stazione Termini, hoping to at least keep warm. But he soon felt lost among the homeless people lining the walls like a hall of mirrors, fighting for the scraps of the day. He fared no better among the blue-blood beggars that ruled the hierarchy of the street. So he wandered aimlessly until he was eventually caught in a stream of tourists and deposited at the Roman Colosseum. Slipping into the tunnels, he found a hidden corner where he curled up to sleep. And he slept. And as he slept, he dreamed. First he imagined he heard the voices of thousands rising around him. Then he imagined the arena was not the crumbling ruin of 1979, but rather the magnificent stadium of 86 A.D. Then he imagined Christians and criminals in the tunnels with him. They were led up a ramp to the floor of the arena, where a pride of lions was led into the ring. One by one he watched as his companions were slaughtered, and when his turn came, he stood tall and welcomed death. Then he opened his eyes. What he saw was much less remarkable than what he had dreamed. He was not in the year 86, and the voices of thousands were not rising around him, and he was not in the middle of the arena awaiting death. In fact, the only thing that bore any resemblance to his fantastic vision was a stray cat that had made its home in the corner where he lay. Disgusted, the captain gave the feline a sharp kick, breaking at least one of its ribs, then wandered back into the streets. As the weeks passed, Harvey watched the daily repetition of the human parade, and he was struck by the tedium of life's three-part cycle: birth, reproduction, death. Birth, reproduction, death. Birth, reproduction, death. The sun and the moon circling, and all the days in between. Birth, reproduction, death. Not immortality, not harmony, not laws, but monotonous motion winding down to death. And what was life's goal, after all? What was the greatest dream? Was it simply not to be cheated? Not to be robbed of a single part of the cycle? To experience as much as any who has come before and any who will come after? Was that all anyone could strive for? All that anyone could ever have? The man-made structures seemed a mockery, fashioned to protect their builders, to fabricate an order that would give life substance, routines, histories, objects a person could touch and hold, raise confidently before their eyes. These were nothing but desperate denials of life's ultimate chaos. And as Harvey saw and thought and listened, his world became centerless and immense. Its order ceased to function, and the most important of its laws, its interpersonal laws, were the first to go. People treating people without respect, without civility, without civilization. So this is Pascal's fear, thought Harvey, as he stumbled through the streets. He stared at the graffiti on the walls, and saw that the walls themselves were graffiti, that the cars were graffiti, that the streets and buildings and signs were graffiti. And as he was Ha! Laughed Aphrodite. Now you will know what it is to live in a world torn apart. Now you will know the jagged edges of a mind run amok. He slept in a bed of roaches. Footnote. The author wrote a number of chapters on the topic of Harvey's desolation in solitude, but in order to preserve the decency that is fitting so heroic an account, he chose to omit them in the final version. Let it suffice to say that Harvey fell into the blackest of unimaginable depths, suffering misery greater than any of the famous penitents in Dante's Inferno or in Part 2 of his own story.